exploring the meaning of other religions, and particularly just reflecting on Christian attitudes toward these other religions. The theme of the whole Holden Village this year is a whole new world, and of course religions are a part of the world. And if we put up a religious map here, I think we would we'd have to tear it apart, you know, cut it up and split it up to kind of indicate all of the wars and conflicts and so forth that have taken place in the history of the world, and especially even in modern times. So what I'm trying to do this week is to suggest that Christians and others need to find ways of contributing toward that whole new world by healing some of these religious differences, by learning to respect each other, to understand each other, and even to learn from each other. It so happens that this week is the Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca. And so I think it's appropriate that we're going to talk about Islam today, and actually tomorrow also. And because of that, I've sort of been working this week with the notion of pilgrimage, thinking of Christians also as pilgrims following a religious path, not as conquerors, not as people building a kingdom, excluding other people and so forth, but as pilgrims, and having fellow pilgrims, like Muslims, right? And, you know, it's kind of nice that Muslims, probably 3 million of them, are right this very minute camped in Mecca, or actually out in the desert in Mina, going through some of the rituals of the pilgrimage, which is one of the symbolic high points of the Muslim religion. Once in your lifetime, if you're a Muslim, you are obligated to make that pilgrimage to Mecca and to join in the representation of the whole human race gathering together in one place to worship the one God. Now, I'm suggesting that maybe we, most of us coming from a Christian background, can think of ourselves also as pilgrims and ask, in what way can we begin to think of Muslims as fellow pilgrims? Which might be a rather dramatic change in attitude toward Muslims. How have Christians generally thought about Muslims in your experience? Either, you know, from personal experience or from what you've picked up from others?
As the other. Mm-hmm.
As what?
The other, just like we Americans think of the communist as the other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Nice word for enemy.
The enemy.
Yeah, I thought you said the word fought with the.
Oh, fought, okay.
It's been a real clash between them. Right. The two cultures, and I think that still comes down through all the time. And I think that in a way we are more threatened by their religion far more than by Buddhism or Hinduism, because it's closer to being a brother religion, so it has a much more of a threat and a challenge.
It's more of a threat.
It's currently the fastest growing religion, is it not?
I think so, partly just because of birth numbers. The parts of the world where Muslims are strong have also very high birth rates. But it's also growing through expansion, through Islamization of the world. It's a threat, I think. I think you're right. And it always has been.
Yeah, I heard by the end of the century there'll be more Muslims in the United States than Jews.
Yeah, that's true. Again, because of immigration and birth rates and so forth. We used to think of America as having three religions, right? At least that was kind of the standard phrase. Catholics, Protestants, and Jews. Well, that's not going to work anymore, because Muslims now will very shortly be a major religion in America, not to say anything about the rest of the world. And so it has always been, right? I think Muslims, as you correctly said, probably more than any of the other religions of the world, have been perceived by Christians as a threat. Now the Jews, that was another story that we talked about yesterday, and you know, there were various reasons why Christians have persecuted and suppressed the Jewish people. But with Muslims, it is a distinct threat. Starting from the very beginning of Islam, shortly after the Prophet Muhammad's death, Islam began a very dramatic expansion and captured the Holy Land about the middle of the 7th century. That was a distinct shock to Christians, right? And then following that up, after capturing the Holy Land and Jerusalem, Muslims moved all the way across North Africa and up into Spain and up into France by the year 730 or so. And that was very much a threat to Christians, right? So, you know, they fought against the Muslims. And they launched the Crusades, right, from Europe in the 11th and 12th centuries to drive back the Muslims and to retake the Holy Land. And then there was a counter move from Islam again in the 14th and 15th centuries when Turkey got strong and became the leaders of the Muslim world, the Ottoman Turks. They expanded into Europe and captured Constantinople, right? Remember what they renamed it? Isn't there a song?
Istanbul.
But you know, that was the capital of Eastern Christendom. And the Muslims took it. And then moreover, they moved into Europe at that point. And so at the time of the Reformation, Christians in Europe were very scared. I think that's reflected in some of the things Martin Luther wrote and so forth. And then, I suppose if we want to finish this little historical seesaw, then there was a counter movement from Europe again, with Europe moving into the Enlightenment and discovering gunpowder and ships and so forth. They sent out their navies to colonize the world and colonize the whole Muslim world. Every Muslim nation practically fell under the control of European powers in the 18th and 19th centuries. Egypt, India, everywhere. And so the 20th century has really been a struggle by Muslim peoples to throw off the Western powers. You know, and one by one, in the 20th century, the Muslim nations have gotten free. You know, Egypt, India, and then India split into Pakistan and Bangladesh, and all of the Muslim nations. So there's really been a kind of titanic struggle between Christendom and the Muslim world. And it's still going on today, in a sense. For many Americans, at least, when you think of Muslim, what do you think of?
Mistrust.
Dirty Arabs. Terrorists, you know, and whatever else you can think of. Well, so that's the background that, you know, that we got to think about when we're talking about a whole new world. This is a world that, in many ways, is split. Particularly, the fault line goes between Christians and Muslims. Now, there's, of course, lots of other splits, too. That's a major one. Because not only is Christianity a religion that is in all the world, but so is Islam. If we just could take a quick moment to look at the map, I could point out, and some of you could point out, too, the places where Muslims are most densely populated, where, you know, where the whole nation or the whole land is virtually Muslim. And that, of course, would be the whole Middle East, across North Africa and Arabia and the Arab countries of the Middle East, including Iraq. But actually, the Arabs make up only a small portion of the whole world of Islam, because then there are also the Turks, right? They're not Arabs. And there's also the Iranians, that huge nation of Iran, which is also not Arab, but Muslim, and Afghanistan. So it's this whole area in here is virtually Muslim, you know, with some others like Christians. And then another major area is Greater India, right, which would include Pakistan and Bangladesh and India. Before the partition in 1948, this was all called India. And it is the largest concentration of Muslims anywhere in the world. Still today, if you add up India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh, there's more Muslims there than anywhere else. And then there are Malaysia and Indonesia. Those are rather thoroughly Muslim. Indonesia has the distinction of being the nation that has the most Muslims. You know, more Muslims live in Indonesia than in any other nation in the world.
You mean percentage per capita?
No, not percentage, okay. Just total numbers. There's more Muslims that live in Indonesia than in any other one nation.
Than in India.
Right. Mm-hmm. Because India is split into three nations, right? Mm-hmm. India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. And then there's the Philippines with a large Muslim population. There's China with a large Muslim population in the western part. We're hearing a lot about the former Soviet Union and the Muslim states now in the southern part of that. And then there is Black Africa, this belt across the sub-Saharan Africa, which is pretty thoroughly Muslim. That's pretty impressive. One important thing to note, just in looking at the map, is that while Christianity tends to be the religion of the industrialized world, or the first world, if we want to call it that, the Western world, the Northern world, Islam is really the religion of what we used to call the Third World, or the underdeveloped nations, the developing nations. That's kind of significant, I think, that they would turn to Islam rather than to Christianity. So I think for various reasons then, Christians have long felt Muslims to be a threat, a competition. But that's not true. I guess that's what I would say. And I'm sure that some of you have come to know some Muslims also. If you really get to know Muslims and talk to them and study their religion, Islam is really a religion of peace. That's actually what one of the fundamental meanings of Islam. Islam can mean submission, but it also comes from the word salam, which means peace or wholeness. It's a religion that promotes the peace and the wholeness of the whole human race. And as one of you said, it's a sibling of Christianity. It's a brother religion in many ways. If we look at Islam historically, we would see that if you start with Abraham, let's say, Abraham as the ancestor of the Jewish people, right? And then Abraham as the ancestor of the Christian people by faith. But Muslims feel that Abraham is the ancestor also of the Muslim people. How so? Does any of you know how that connection works with Abraham so that these three religions are kind of considered one family of religions?
Well, it's his concubine that had
Ishmael.
Right. Abraham and Sarah were childless, so Sarah gave Abraham her maid, Hagar, as his wife, and by her, Abraham had a son, his firstborn son, right? His first son was Ishmael. According to the Muslim story, Ishmael and Hagar went down to Mecca in Saudi Arabia, and that's where Abraham left them, and from them came the whole people of the Meccans, and Muhammad was born from them. So Muhammad the prophet then would be a direct descendant from Abraham through his son Ishmael. So that's the connection. Now what I want to do is talk just a little bit about Muhammad as the prophet and founder of Islam, and then maybe just focus on the central teaching of Islam. What is Islam all about? And then we can come back and talk a little bit more about relations between Christians and Muslims. The Prophet Muhammad was born in Mecca, as I think everybody probably knows, right over here on the Arabian Peninsula. And this was about 6 centuries after the time of Christ, in the year 570 after Christ. So Christianity had already spread through various parts of the world, including into the Arabian Peninsula, and tribes there knew about Christianity. Some of the tribes had become Christian. There were also Jewish tribes living there in the desert. But the religion of most of the people was the desert religion, the Bedouin religion, which involved the worship of many gods and spirits.
jinns and genies of the desert, the high god, and they called Allah, right? The god Allah, the god of the sky, but also the daughters of Allah and many other gods. The central shrine there at Mecca, which was called the Kaaba, housed 360 statues of all these different desert gods and goddesses and so forth. Right, so there was kind of a big blend of religions. And it was in this setting that Muhammad was born. And we don't need to go into his whole life story, but already as a youth he was, you know, recognized as a very religious seeker, searcher after the truth. He was a monotheist, even though he wasn't a Christian or a Jew, but he didn't believe in all of these gods and goddesses, but just the one God. He got married, had children, and when he was about 40 years old, he started the practice of going off to the mountains to meditate, which I think we can understand around here. Wouldn't be too far out to spend a day up in the mountains meditating, and that's what he started doing. And on one of those times, when he was meditating in a cave in the mountains, he underwent a shattering experience of receiving a revelation from God, from Allah, right? Through the means of the angel Gabriel. The angel Gabriel spoke to him and gave him this revelation from God, basically telling him, you know, there's one God, and God wants you to go and talk to the people of Mecca and tell them to stop worshiping these other gods and so forth. And then after that first revelation, when he was about 40, periodically for the rest of his life, he lived about 20 more years, Muhammad received more revelations again and again, bringing new information about what to believe in, new information particularly about how to live, laws for the proper kind of life and so forth. Now, as you probably already know, all of these revelations then that came to Muhammad eventually were collected together, written down, and that is the Quran, right? The holy book of Islam. Now, Muhammad didn't write it. Muhammad was illiterate. His job was to recite it. But the people who heard him memorized the words and collected them together and wrote them down as the holy book. Well, Muhammad began to preach these new revelations to the people of Mecca, and of course, as you might expect, they refused to believe him. You know, he was simply one of them. Who is this guy who thinks he can come and tell us what we should do? Of course, they didn't want to follow what he was telling them, because it would mean closing down all of their shrines and stopping the religious trade of pilgrims coming to Mecca to perform, you know, the various rituals and so forth. So basically, the people of Mecca rejected Muhammad. There were some that believed. His wife, right, Khadija, was the first one who believed, and then there was his cousin Ali and a handful of others. They believed and became the first Muslims. The word means submitters, right? Islam means submission and Muslim means submitters. The first ones who submitted to God. But by and large, the rest of the people refused to accept Muhammad. They made fun of him, they ridiculed him, they chased him out, they tried to kill him. The only reason that his life was spared was that his own clan protected him. You know, in this Bedouin society, there's a very, very strong obligation on fellow clan members to protect other clan members. Even though they didn't believe him, they still protected him. But unfortunately, in the year 619, the head of his clan died, and also his wife died, and Muhammad was left unprotected. So he had to leave Mecca. Fortunately, there were some people that came down from Medina, a city about 200 miles north of Mecca, on one of these religious fairs, and met Muhammad, and they were very impressed with him, and they invited him up to Medina. So in the year 622, Muhammad and the other few Muslims immigrated from Mecca to Medina. This is a very famous event in the history of Islam. It's called the Hijra, or the immigration. And the reason it's so important is that in Medina, Muhammad was able to establish Islam. The whole city accepted him. The whole city became the congregation of Islam. So Muhammad then was able to put the whole way of life into practice that Islam is. As we'll see in a minute, Islam is really a total way of life. And that was possible in Medina. So for Muslims, this is year one. This is the birthday of Islam, and they date their calendars from that. Right? That's year one for Islam. Muhammad continued to receive more revelations to fill out the full way of life. He and some Muslim armies fought against the people of Mecca, and eventually in the year 630, Mecca surrendered to Muhammad, and the whole Arabian Peninsula became Islam, basically, by the death of Muhammad in 632. That's quite an achievement, you know, in the last, basically, 20 years of his life. He started receiving revelations and converted the whole people of Arabia. They all became what is called the Ummah, or the congregation, or fellowship, community of Islam. The church, right? It's like Christians speak of the church, the Christian church. So in Islam, you speak of the Ummah, everybody who belongs to Islam. Now, one characteristic of the Ummah, an important characteristic, is that there's no separation of politics and the legal system and religion. You know, everything is bound up together as one total unity. Okay, that's the life of Muhammad. Maybe just a word about what happened immediately after he died. The expansion of Islam continued under the successors, who were called the caliphs, the first four caliphs in particular. Islam expanded then very rapidly beyond the Arabian Peninsula, up into Palestine and Iraq and Iran. Also expanded across North Africa. And as I mentioned before, before very long, up into Spain and even into France. So within 20 or 30 years after the death of Muhammad, this religion had spread, you know, all across the Middle East. It's fantastic. I don't know of anything else like it in the history of any religion. Such a dramatic expansion. Now, of course, some people have the notion that the expansion took place by warfare, which isn't really true. There certainly was some warfare. There were some battles. But mostly the expansion took place because all of these people were subjugated to the great powers of the day, the Byzantine Empire or the Persian Empire. And Islam came along, freeing them from these overlords and offering them a religion that was very attractive to them. So it really expanded, and it kept expanding ever since, I guess we could say. Well, what is it that Islam is all about? That's just a little look at the life of Muhammad. But what is it that he was teaching? What is it that this religion is all about that makes it so attractive to so many people?
You don't have to wait till you die to get something.
Okay. Yeah, there's, and it brings it to you. It brings you a whole way of life that is very fulfilling.
Mm-hmm. I think the dedication to God. Mm-hmm. They can see that, you know, they don't, you know, the five pillars, they're strict on it.
Mm-hmm. Right, there's a total dedication. To be Muslim means to submit to God. And you, as you mentioned, the five pillars that we'll be talking about, which are very simple practices, and yet very meaningful. Let me maybe just to lay out a little bit of the heart of Islam, what Islam is all about. Let me talk a little bit about the creed of Islam. Right. We were talking about Christianity. What do Christians believe? I suppose we could start with the Apostles' Creed and, you know, kind of lay it out.
On and on.
It goes on and on and on. Well, as you know and others, the Muslim creed is very short, isn't it? Called the Shahada. And what does it say, basically?
There is no God but Allah and Muhammad is his prophet.
Okay, there is no God but Allah and Muhammad is his prophet. And it's even a very delightful thing to hear. In Arabic, it's made up mostly of L's. And if you have an Arab speaking it, those L's just roll out. I can't do it. It goes La ilaha illa Allah, Muhammad Rasul Allah. But that doesn't quite do it. You have to hear an Arab say it. But what it means is no God but God. That's the one half of it. And the other half is that Muhammad is the messenger of God. And that's all you have to say. That makes you a Muslim. Well, you have to believe it, because intent is very important. But with intention in your heart, you say this, there's no God but God, and Muhammad is his messenger, and you are a Muslim. It's the first thing that's said to a baby when a baby is born, and it's the last thing that is spoken to a dying person. So it just kind of encapsulates what Islam is all about. Now, it may not be real obvious, so let me say a few more things about this little creed and the vision of the world that's expressed there. No God but God. Notice I've changed it a little bit. You said no God but Allah. But Allah is simply the Arabic word for God, the God. So it's not so much the word Allah that is the important thing, but the unity of God. Right? That's the number one Muslim teaching, the foundation Muslim teaching, the unity of God. God totally and completely fills up the whole divine realm with no partners, no competitors, no divisions. There is just God, the unity of God. The Tawheed, they call it, and that's what they're willing to fight for. That is the ultimate thing that needs to be upheld. Those who don't uphold that commit the most grievous sin possible, which is called shirk, or associating something else with God. Right? That's compromising the unity of God. Whether it's another person, or an automobile, or a king, or worshiping, you know, the sun, or whatever. All of those things would be ways of putting something else in the place where God should be. Right?
And would they say that this God is the God of Abraham?
Sure. There is no other God, so it would have to be. Right? The God of Abraham, the God of the people of India, you know, there is no other God. It's incomprehensible to Muslims. Okay, so it's a very strong emphasis on the unity of God, monotheism, right? But that maybe is not enough, because Christians are also monotheists, and so are Jews, and so forth. So maybe a couple of other things to be said about what this means. Once you say there is one God only, then according to Muslims, it follows that God is transcendent. Kind of a hard word that simply means beyond the creation. God is not mixed together in this creation, like the tree is not God, or a human being is not God, or these 360 idols or statues in the shrine at Mecca are not gods. God is not, cannot be drawn down into the created world and worshipped as God in a created form, right? That's what it means to say God is transcendent. There's a big separation between God and the created realm. There are really two realms. There's the divine realm and there's the created realm. And you don't mix the two together. Because once you mix the two together, then you've got more than one God, right? Whether you mix it together by worshiping trees and statues, or, in the case of Christians, worshiping Jesus Christ as, you know, as a form of God. To Muslims, that means you've got two gods, right? So that's a very important emphasis. Then, along with that, there's a strong push
on the notion of Almighty, which, you know, I think is Christians and Jews, we also believe that God is Almighty, but Muslims carry it much further. You know, all might belongs to God. If it didn't, then there would be other gods, right? If God has 99% of the might and somebody else has 1% of the might, then you've got a competitor to God. So somehow or other, God has all of the power. Now that raises some difficult questions, of course, about free will and human responsibility and so forth. But Muslims have ways of dealing with those questions too. Even though God has all of the power, God allows some creatures to have some power, like free will and so forth. But this is an important emphasis. And with that, the notion that God is the creator of everything. The verses in the Quran over and over again talk about God, you know, as the creator of everything that exists. Now, that doesn't mean that God is totally absent. If we continued our list, we would say that God is also present in creation. Not to be worshipped in creation, but present as the Almighty Creator. There's a passage in the Quran that says, wherever you look, whether it's to the east or to the west, you see the face of God. Right? Wherever you look, there's the face of God. And there's another passage that says, God is closer to us than our jugular vein. Right? And that's about as close as you can get to yourself, and God is closer. So there is a strong Muslim sense for what we might call mysticism, that is a sense of a very close union with God. But at the same time, they insist that God is not like anything, so that God could be worshipped. Even language, you have to be careful with language. For example, you can't call God Father in Islam, because God is not a father. That's taking God and bringing God down into the creation and saying God is a father. So maybe you've noticed that in talking to Muslims, they don't like it if you call God Father or Mother either, for that matter. But the notion that even our words have the tendency to pull God down into creation and thus to make God into something that we worship in addition to the one God. Then I think we should probably add another corollary, that if there is only one God, or if we speak strongly about the unity of God, then it's possible to speak about the unity of the world, particularly of the human world, but of the whole world. And that's a strong emphasis then in Islam, that because there's one God, therefore there's one world. There's one human race. There's not different races split up, because if you split up the human race, you're also splitting up God. And it is the unity of God then that guarantees the unity of the whole human community. And it's on that basis then that Islam has very strong feelings about equality and justice, that people are equal. And all people deserve, a living wage. And whenever there is injustice, when one person, when one nation is oppressing another nation, that is grounds for a holy war to rectify the situation and so forth. So I think that's important to note too, that it is the oneness of God that guarantees the oneness of the human race. Humans are valued very highly in Islam. They are not only servants of God, but they are what is called caliphs in the Quran. That is, in a sense, fellow rulers with God. There's a famous passage in which God speaks to the angels and the other powers of creation, and ultimately winds up giving the viceroyship to humans. And the reason for that, according to Muslims, is that it's only humans that God has given intelligence and free will. Everything else in creation simply submits to God. whether it's the sun and the moon or the rain or the grass or the forest, everything simply does God's will. Right? Rain falls, trees grow, all of that according to God's design. It's only humans that God has given intelligence and free will. So even though we follow God's design in most that we do, you know, like our heart beating and our, you know, our hair falling out and all of the rest that we don't have any control over, we as humans do have a small arena of freedom where we can decide, you know, to follow God's design or to not follow God's design. So that's an important point.
Mm-hmm. You speak about everybody being equal. And I was just wondering about the male being much more equal, though. And is that just a practice rather than the theory? That's true in most religions.
It's true in most religions, and it's, you know, if you talk to Muslims, they, you know, they're totally convinced that men and women are completely equal, and that's what the Quran says, but they have different roles, right? And it's in those different roles, then, that many of us see some great inequalities taking place. And we can talk more about that later if you want. But the official Muslim position is total equality. Right? Okay, now all of that, you know, and much more comes from this idea of one God. And that, in a way, is the whole Muslim vision. But the basic question then for humans with our realm of free will that we have and the need to make decisions is, as far as Muslims are concerned, guidance, right? Where do we go for guidance? How do we know what God's design is, what God's will is? Now, on the one hand, Muslims do affirm the goodness of the whole created world, and the idea that we can learn about God by studying ourselves in the world, right? So that theoretically, at least, there's a promotion of science and knowledge and investigation in Islam. You know, whatever you find out about the world, you are really finding out about God. But that's not enough, of course. The real guidance that God provides for us as human beings comes through the messengers. So that's the second part of the creed, right? Muhammad is the messenger of God. Now that has also been much misunderstood, I think. That doesn't mean that Muhammad is God, or that Muhammad is a savior, or that you know, that Muhammad is the only prophet to believe in. It simply means that Muhammad is the final prophet, right? The last prophet. That's what it means. Now, there have been many, many prophets before Muhammad. There's a whole line of prophets, actually going back to the first human being, which was Adam. You know, God created Adam and Eve, and they had a family. That was the first human community, and God then spoke through Adam as the first prophet to that community. And the Quran says that God has provided prophets or messengers to every human community. There's not a human community in the history of the world that has not received a prophet from God. You know, that's kind of a mind-boggling concept. Now, all of these prophets, you know, spoke the languages of those people, lived in those cultures. Most of them, you know, didn't write anything, because most cultures have been non-literate. So eventually their words were forgotten. But there have been prophets to everybody. The most important prophets are those that have provided writings. This would be the prophets of the Old Testament and the New Testament, right? Because their words have been written down, and so Jews and Christians are spoken of as people of the book. They have the words of the prophets, you know, starting with Adam and then David and Moses and Abraham and Isaiah and so forth. Those are all prophets. And also Jesus is a prophet. So the gospel that contains the words of Jesus is revelation from God. The problem, of course, that in all of these cases, and some Muslims number them at 124,000 prophets,
In all of these cases, eventually the words of the prophets have either been forgotten or sometimes they've been distorted. And that's what happened in the case of the Jews and the Christians. Some of those words of the prophets have been changed and distorted. What would be the major distortion that has happened with the words of the prophet Jesus, for example?
That he's the Son of God.
That he's the Son of God, right? God can't have a son. You know, that's incomprehensible to Muslims. So while they believe that most of the words of Jesus have been preserved, they think that Christians have changed it and, you know, written in there that Jesus is the Son of God. Because of those errors and changes, it is necessary for there to be a final prophet. And that's the prophet Muhammad. Right? God gave revelation to Muhammad one more time, not a new revelation, but really the same revelation that had been given to all of the prophets. Only this time it was given directly, it was recited immediately, it was memorized by the people who heard it, it was written down so that there's no changes, no errors, no mistakes, and thus you have the perfect revelation, which is the Quran. And that then is the heart of Islam. That's the heart and the soul of the Muslim religion is that holy book, which represents God's guidance to humans. In many ways, the place that Jesus Christ plays for Christians as, you know, God's revelation to humans is taken in Islam by the Quran. That's the meeting point. That's where the divine realm and the human realm come together. It's in that holy book, which according to Muslims is really eternal. It never was created. It's God's eternal holy book that he articulated or created in Arabic through the angel Gabriel, and it was written down in the human created language. But it's really the eternal uncreated book. And thus it provides everything that we need. And it's on the basis then of the Quran that the whole Muslim way of life is laid out. It's particularly in what is called the Islamic law or the Sharia, which is simply a name for all of those rules and regulations and guidance that have been developed from the Quran to provide a total way of life for Muslims. It covers everything. What kind of government you should have, how you should get married, particularly family matters, economics, things like you're not supposed to practice usury, loaning money to people and requiring interest in return, and everything that makes up the Muslim way of life is then drawn from the Quran. Okay, I think that's enough of a picture into Islam to let us talk a little bit about it.
Could you say just real briefly, I can't remember, where was, if they believe that they had Abraham in common ancestry with mm-hmm. the Jewish people, mm-hmm. where did they split off so violently from the Jewish people?
Well, speaking from the Muslim point of view, they never did split off from the Jewish people. Actually, what Muhammad is bringing is simply a revitalization of the revelation that was given through the Jewish people and through the Christian people. That's simply being restored now in the revelation through Muhammad. And there, you know, there's indications that when he started proclaiming this message, he expected the Christians and the Muslims to believe. I mean, the Christians and the Jews. Well, they didn't, right? But from the Muslim point of view, Islam is simply the fulfillment of what both Judaism and Christianity were supposed to be. Now, the reason there's antagonism that has developed, the main reason, is that neither Jews nor Christians have acknowledged Muhammad as the prophet. Right? Even though, according to Muslims, that is the fulfillment, Jews and Christians refuse to believe that. So that's where the antagonism arises then.
So that might be Jews refusing to believe that Christ is the Messiah?
Right, and in the same way, Christians insist that Jewish people should believe that Jesus Christ is the fulfillment. But Jews don't believe that. So it's almost another stage in the development in these three religions.
But it seems like oftentimes when we talk about the stuff going on in the Middle East, that they say, oh, it's a battle, it's an argument, it's a conflict that began back in biblical times.
No, that's not really true. Maybe I missed what you were saying. According to Muslims, there really isn't any antagonism with Jews or Christians. Now, it's unfortunate that Jews and Christians do not accept Muhammad as the final messenger, yet they are people of the book. And that makes Jews and Christians different from the other religions of the world, because they have the holy books and they have the belief in the one God. Muslims do consider Jews and Christians to be monotheists. And therefore, throughout history, they have, even in a Muslim state that is, you know, ruled according to Islamic law and has a Muslim ruler and everything, they have permitted Jews and Christians to live. Now, they've not permitted other religions to live, but Jews and Christians are permitted to live there. In the Islamic legal system, it is permissible for a Muslim man to marry a Christian or a Jewish woman. You know, so there's indications like that that show an acceptance of Jews and Christians under Muslim terms. And really, there hasn't been a lot of antagonism. The antagonism has come the other way. It was the Christians who, threw the Crusades against the Muslims. Right? And in many ways, Jews had a much better life living in Muslim lands than they did in Christian lands.
Maybe the biblical thing that they're referring to would be where Sarah actually picked out the the arrow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's referred to sometimes, that Sarah was jealous of Hagar and Ishmael and forced Abraham to, you know, kick them out in the desert and so forth. But I haven't heard that mentioned too much among Muslims. So, what I didn't mention at all is that probably the heart of the Sharia involves the five worships of God, or the five pillars, as the obligations that all Muslims are supposed to fulfill. Islamic law lists various kinds of requirements for people, but they're under different categories. Some things are absolutely commanded, like the five pillars. Some things are absolutely prohibited, like getting drunk, drinking alcohol, and other things. Some things are strongly recommended, you know, like saying extra prayers and lots of things like that. Some things are strongly advised against, like cigarette smoking and various other things. And then some things are just neutral. You know, it doesn't really matter if you do them or not. But in that way, they manage to sort of encompass everything about human life within a rather flexible system of ethics. But among those things that are required are the five pillars. And what I thought I would do is talk about them in particular tomorrow. They include saying the creed, which we've talked about a little bit, and prayer five times a day, providing alms or sharing your wealth with those who are poor, fasting during the month of Ramadan, and going on the pilgrimage, the Hajj, or the pilgrimage. And I think those very, very clearly give you a picture of what Islam is all about, so I thought I would spend the time tomorrow talking about the five pillars in particular. But what do you think about Islam? Do you have some more questions, or you have some ideas about?
One question before we leave that on the five. I always thought it was three times a day. Can you approximately tell us when, or exactly tell us for that matter, the five times?
Five times a day is the requirement, and it is at first light, at dawn.
Oh, okay.
When I lived in Jordan, that meant 2:30 in the morning. The call to prayer would come. And then noon, and then mid-afternoon, sundown, and when it gets dark at night, five times. Now, if
there are reasons that prohibit you from doing that, like you're on a journey, then it is possible sometimes to combine two of them together, and that this is maybe where the idea of three comes from. But no, five is the obligation.
Did Muhammad make any comments about Jesus as a prophet?
Mm-hmm. Many comments. There are lots of things that Muhammad said and also that the Quran says about Jesus. And maybe it would be helpful to comment on that just a little bit. First of all, the Quran accepts the virgin birth of Jesus, right? God chose Mary, and there's a whole chapter in the Quran on Mary. God chose Mary, purified her, breathed his spirit into her, and she conceived and bore Jesus. And there's some interesting things about Jesus. When he was born, he immediately stood up and walked and said, I am the Messiah. I will be highly honored in this world and in the next. Jesus went around performing miracles, like raising the dead and so forth. But the main thing that Jesus did, according to the Quran, is to teach the Jews some new interpretations of the Torah, according to God's will. The Jews wrongly accused him and Mary of grave sins, and so they thought that they crucified him. But the Quran says they didn't really crucify him. God provided another form on the cross, and Jesus didn't die. Rather, God took Jesus to heaven. Right? So there's high respect for the prophet Jesus, both in the Quran and in Islam. You don't dare say bad things about the prophet Jesus around Muslims. Remember when that movie was being shown, what was the name of it that caused such a furor? Last Temptation of Christ. Muslims were probably more upset about that than Christians were, because they have high respect for the prophet Jesus. Just like when they mention the name of the prophet Muhammad, they say, peace and the blessings of God be upon him. When they mention the name of Jesus, they say that too.
Was Muhammad immaculately conceived?
No. But Jesus was. there's many things like that about Jesus. Now, of course, the thing that they insist on is that he's not the Savior, he's not the Son of God, he didn't die for the sins of the world, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Do you think they accurately cover, the origin of evil, that was such a problem in early Christianity, the idea of Augustine finally turned back towards Christianity because he discovered it did have room for evil. Uh-huh. And do you think they cover that with their freedom of the will, or do they also have a devil figure, Satan?
Well, they have a devil figure, Iblis, and a number of Satans. And these were angels who disobeyed God. Actually, when God created humans, and made them into God's viceroys on earth, God commanded the angels to bow down and worship humans. And they all did, except for Iblis. And in disobeying God, then he became the evil one. But keep in mind that with this Muslim notion of the unity of God, there cannot be any competitor to God. So they're very clear on the fact that while there is an Iblis, the only thing that Iblis can do is whatever God permits Iblis to do. And of course that means going around tempting people, testing their faith and so forth. Now the origin of evil in Islam is rather clear. It arises out of human free will. And particularly out of ignorance and forgetfulness. Right, that would be the Muslim way of talking about why human beings commit sin and do wrong things. It's because we forget who we really are. We really are creatures of God, and thus our proper role is to serve God. But we forget that, and we start serving ourselves. There's this notion of two inclinations, similar to the Jewish idea that within us there's an inclination to worship God, but there is also the pull of the passions and the needs. And sometimes we let those passions so overwhelm us that we forget to serve God, and we, you know, fall into evil and sin.
So it would definitely say that you could never serve God by being passionate.
No, oh no, that's not true. You serve God by being passionate.
But not about your body.
No, about your body. It's a rather sensual religion. Sexuality is strongly affirmed in Islam, starting with the Prophet Muhammad. But the idea is that sexuality is to be expressed within God's design. And the Sharia then places that within marriage.
So they would not have any marriage. What do they feel about homosexuality?
That's a difficult one. Generally, it's disapproved, as far as I know. Yeah, because it's not within the marriage relationship, the marriage contract. In fact, it's a contract between a man and a woman in Islam, and that's the realm for sexuality.
Mm-hmm. I had a question that just brought up, and then I had another one that I had before. I've heard that one of the problems with the spread of AIDS, particularly towards women in Africa, is that in the Muslim cultures, the men have numerous relationships outside of marriage and bring home AIDS to their wives. How does that fit in with what you...
They're not supposed to.
They're not supposed to. It's not sanctioned.
It's not sanctioned.
They were forgetful.
They were forgetful. Definitely. They were also
forgetful.
Now, Islam does allow, and the Quran allows for multiple marriage contracts on the part of the man, up to four, as you know. Islam allows for multiple marriage contracts on the part of a man.
Okay.
Not on the part of a woman, on the part of a man.
Of course,
up
that's
to four. But the Quran also says that then it is the man's obligation to treat those wives equally, in both in affection and in support. So many Muslims say that is a virtual prohibition against polygamy. And there are very few Muslims, actually, that have more than one wife. But it is permitted. There's also a tricky little legal measure in the Shia segment of Islam, which allows for what is called temporary marriage, which has obviously been much abused. I mean, a man and a woman can make a contract for one day. Right? And they're married for one day, and then the marriage is dissolved at the end of that time. But I mean, most Muslims frown upon that legality very much. The practice that you refer to is certainly not in keeping with Islamic teaching.
My other question was, you talked earlier about the spread of Islam, and not just through birth, but is there a proselytizing element? And if so, how does that work? And what would the missionary appeal be, or how would that be carried out?
Yeah, Islam is a missionary religion, just like Christianity. And the appeal is to reason. I mean, this is the way Islam approaches it, that Islam is a religion of knowledge and reason. The Quran says, don't believe anything unless you are convinced of it. The idea is that if you really study the Quran, and if you listen to the teachings of Quran, and use your intelligence, which God has created, you will finally become convinced that is the truth. And after that, being rationally convinced, which is called faith, actually, it's rational certitude or iman, then the next step is Islam, or submission to God. Now, of course, you know, to an outsider, it looks like that's a matter of faith and conversion and so forth. But the approach Islam uses is that this is reasonable. Any person who really, truly uses his or her intellect will become rationally convinced that this is the truth.
hearing on from her question, mm-hmm. what is their philosophy of family size and birth control? And
well, I don't think the religious law says too much about that, and of course there you do get into all the different cultures of Islam, you know, in Saudi Arabia and, you know, in the Gulf states there might be one way of approaching it, but in Malaysia and Pakistan it'd be quite different. But generally, as in many traditional cultures, the idea was that the more children the better. And that was partly the rationale for multiple wives, is to have more children. And then, you know, and then there can be, the family itself is a very important unit, obviously. And the more people there are in the family unit, the better it is, the more prosperous you can be and so forth.
How about divorce and abortion?
Abortion is generally frowned on. I don't know if it is totally prohibited, but it is certainly frowned on. Divorce is allowed. There are proper structures of divorce. Traditionally, it was very easy for the man to divorce the woman. It was harder.